hopefully. Okay, before we start with our real lecture, we had one question after last lecture that is relevant for everybody, so I will answer it today. Because the exam is only 1 month away, I think it's important to talk about which helpers are allowed in the exam. Just like the last semesters, we will allow a one-sided DIN A4 paper as a cheat sheet during the exam. It's very important that you only have handwritten notes in that, so no printing allowed, and also not to write on an iPad or a Surface or whatever and print it out, because we want to have some repetition while creating these cheat sheets by the students. So while creating the cheat sheet, you will repeat the most important things, because you have to select things to put in the cheat sheet and things like that. And this repetition is also a very good learning experience, in our opinion. So you will have to do it by hand, on your own. And we will collect those cheat sheets after the exam, so you can't hand them over to a second student, so this student also has this learning experience. We will not allow calculators, however, in the exam. I think there was a question in the forum regarding that. Of course, if you take a look at the current, for example, classification exercises, there have been pretty complicated computations in that. We do not expect you to be able to compute a logarithm of 1/5 in your head, of course. That's nothing we will expect of you. There will be computations in the exam, however, they will be of a pretty low level, so everybody should be able to do them in their head if they can do basic math. But there will not be any difficult computations during the exam. That's also a pretty good hint on which formulas might be relevant for the exam and which won't be relevant. Because if we, for example, take a look at a Gaussian distribution, a pretty complicated formula, even with the simplest values, nobody will be able to calculate a Gaussian distribution in their head. That's something that we are aware of. So there's nearly no probability, and a probability close to zero, that we will ask you for a Gaussian distribution in the form, in the exam, because it's hard to compute in your head. If we have, for example, a decision tree induction, we have to make sure you can calculate those things in your head. So while not having a calculator might be worrying for you, it's actually something very good for you, because it lowers the amount of things we can ask for in the exam. You just have to think about that this way. Besides that, in the exam, we will also ask you to bring a correction ruler, because most of our exams, of our exam questions will be multiple choice or single choice questions. We will mark them in the exam, whether they are single choice or multiple choice. And we will scan your exams and automatically correct those questions, single choice and multiple choice. That's done via an object recognition algorithm, which requires you to mark a certain spot on the exam. So there is a chance that you will have these little rectangles on the exam for yes and no, or of course there might be more options than two options, but let's go with yes and no. And there are little rectangles besides that. You will have to fill them out fully for them to be counted as marked. However, there might be a case where you mark something and then realize it's not the correct answer. Then, of course, you have to cross it out. If you would cross it out this way, our object recognition algorithm wouldn't recognize that. So you would need something to write the space out again, because then it's recognized as not marked. And that can be done via a correction roller, not correction fluid in the exam. But those are things I will talk about in the last lecture of the semester again. But if you have to order a correction roller, you might think about that in the next time. Maybe I put a little note on the forum as well, and things like that. So allowed helpers, one-sided DIN A4 cheat sheet, handwritten, not printed, will be collected after the exam, no calculators, and we recommend a correction roller to correct wrong answers, wrongly marked answers in the exam. Those are the most important things to talk about the exam today. Of course, in the last lecture, we will talk about the exam in some more detail afterwards. And if you have questions, of course, you can always ask them in the forum or things like that. Okay. Are there any questions regarding the exam right now? Okay, I don't guess so. Then we can go back to clustering. We stopped in the chapter, in the subsection of hierarchical clustering, one very specific sub kind of clustering methods, where we can go either from small clusters to bigger clusters, combining them together through agglomerative clustering, or can split them via divisive clustering. We stopped at BIRCH. BIRCH is a method called balanced iterative reducing and clustering using hierarchies. So it's also a hierarchical clustering approach, of course, which has one very specific feature to talk about, because it's utilizing a tree. We already know trees from other methods, like fpgrowth, for example. And this is, again, trying to speed up the process of, in this case, clustering using a tree. The clustering feature tree, CF tree, in this case, which supports a multi-phase clustering approach. We have one phase that is used to create an initial tree, and then based on that initial tree, we can speed up our real clustering steps. So combining, in this case, it's agglomerative clustering, features together to build a new cluster, and then combining them together again to build a new cluster, and so on, to create these different kinds of layers of clusters in our tree. The good thing of that is comparable to fpgrowth. We only have to scan the original data once. Well, in fpgrowth, we have to scan it twice, but in this case, we just have to scan it once. One big disadvantage is that we need a very specific kind of data to use BIRCH, because we need numerical data. Why? That's pretty easy to answer if you take a look at those trees or the CFs in that tree. A clustering feature CF is basically a tuple of N, LS, and SS. N is simply the number of data points in that cluster. So we simply would count how many data points are within our cluster. If you take a look at both clusters down here, we have right now two clusters, one on the left, one on the right side. We can count in one cluster, we have 5 data points. So this clustering feature would contain 5 as the first value. Then LS is the linear sum of data points for each axis. In this case, we have 2 axes, so we have to sum up every axis. For the x-axis, if we sum up every data point value or every x-coordinate of every data point, we would have 1 plus 2 plus 2 plus 3 plus 3, and we end up with 16. And for the y-axis, we would sum up 4 plus 5 plus 6 plus 7 plus 8, and we would end up with 30. So just adding up, summing up all coordinates of all data points contained. And the same thing is done again, but squared. So we square the amounts. So 3 squared is 9, plus 2 squared is 4, and so on. To end up with 54 for the x-axis and 190 for the y-axis. Now you can ask, why do we need that? Basically, that's useful because many algorithms use one of these, one or more of these values to determine whether clusters are close together or not close together. For example, if we would take the centroid of these points, we can compute the centroid using the linear sum and n, because we can use that to compute. And basically, that's the computation of a centroid. Dividing 16 through 5 and 30 through 5. And then we end up with the centroid of that cluster. And therefore, also the average point of a cluster. You might remember we had different distance measurements, and we also had an average distance that can, a mean distance, which is based on the centroids. So if you have the centroids, we can also calculate the mean distance between two clusters in hierarchical clustering. And that's why we have these clustering features for every cluster. In Birch, we start with an initial small cluster. We start with the smallest cluster possible. And then we try to combine our things. Basically, we can calculate the centroid. That's what I already said. We can also calculate things like the radius of a cluster or the diameter of a cluster. Those are all things that we can compute with these things. So we have a lot of things that we can do. And we have one second thing we can do with these clustering features, because we know that if we combine two clusters together, we can also combine these clustering features without taking a look at the original points. So basically, and I will skip up to here, if we have low-level clustering features, two small clusters, and we combine them together to a bigger cluster by going one layer up, then we can compute the clustering feature of a bigger cluster by just adding up every value. So we have to add up the n values. If one cluster contains 5 values, data points, and the other cluster contains 5 data points, then we end up with 10 data points in the bigger cluster. If the linear sum of one cluster is 16 and 30, and the other cluster contains maybe 14 and 30, then we end up with the combined sum of 30 and 60. Pretty easy to compute. And that is a good, good thing, because we never have to go back to the original data points. And it's basically an additive feature of the clustering features of the CFs. The CF tree itself, I already gave you a sneak peek on the CF tree, is a height balance tree. So we try to have the same height in every branch, in every direction. Which is again helpful to end up with same size or roughly same size clusters. We need two parameters to get to that. We need the branching factor B, which gives us a maximum number of children we can have per clustering feature. And we need a threshold T, which tells us the maximum diameter of subclusters stored in these leaf nodes. We have seen the formula for diameter already here, we have it a second time. The diameter is the average pairwise distance within a cluster. That's the definition of a diameter in this case. And then, if we, for example, have B set to 7 and T set to 6, so branching factor set to 7, threshold set to 6, we end up, for example, like a tree like this, where we have different clusters in every layer. In this case, we have 6 clusters at max, 7 clusters at max, to be precise, and we can combine them together to get to a bigger cluster. So in this case, we do not only combine two clusters, but multiple clusters. The general algorithm of Birch in phase one, so in the phase where we construct the initial tree, is basically we check every point, every data point, find the closest leaf entry to that, add that leaf entry, and update our CF, our clustering feature. And once we get to our threshold of the max diameter, then we split the leaf node and end up with a new parent. So on the lowest layer, we simply add new points until we satisfy our diameter threshold. And once we get that, we create a new leaf node in this case. This information, of course, that we had a new split occurring, have to be transferred to the above layer, and maybe to the next layer, and maybe to the next layer, and so on, to update these childs as well, because clustering features are additive. So we have to update that. This is basically a complexity of big O n, so linear. We have a linear complexity for that. The problems of that basic algorithm are that this algorithm is pretty sensitive to the order of data points the insert into that thing. Because we might end up with, maybe I should do an example on the blackboard. Let's say we have this data point. Let's say we start, in one example, we start with this data point. Then we search for the closest leaf node entry, which is this one. And then this one. And then let's remove that, this one. That's not good for explaining the next thing, so let's go with that one. But now we are here, and now we are here. In this case, we would have had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We would have added 1, 2, and let's go with maximum elements per layer of 2. Then for 3, we would have had a split. So we would have updated here, updated here. And now 5 would again lead to a split. While if we would have started with this data point, these two would be first to the add, so 5 and 3, and would become a cluster together. So once they are not in the same leaf as before, and once they are in the same leaf, so sensitive to order, while sticking to our algorithm. And that's what insertion order is giving. Also, due to us fixing the maximum number of things, of course we can have smaller clusters, but since we have to apply a certain fixed number of things, it might appear that you have not a natural number of data points within one cluster. For example, if we have, again, some data points, it might be natural to put these into one cluster and these into two other clusters. That might be what you want to do if you create natural clusters. With this limitation of node sizes, we can't have that. And also, we have a tendency to become spherical clusters, to get spherical clusters and diameter measures. That's due to this limitation of the threshold T. That's a basic algorithm for phase one. For phase two, we can apply multiple different algorithms, so we won't get into detail on that. That's just about the creation of the initial CF tree, sorry. Okay, any questions regarding Birch? Then we can go to the next hierarchical clustering algorithm. In this case, we are talking about Chameleon. And we will talk about that in less detail because we had enough hierarchical clustering methods. But a Chameleon is a good example for another kind of closeness measure. We had talked about the closeness measurement, but not about a particular algorithm about that. Because in this case, we measure similarity based on a pretty dynamic model. Because we merge two clusters in this case only if the interconnectivity, the distance between, the interconnectivity between two clusters is high relative to other clusters. So we try to maximize the interconnectivity compared to the intraconnectivity. Again, we have a two-phase algorithm where we first apply a graph partitioning algorithm, and then we use an agglomerative hierarchical clustering algorithm. basically, this is phase one. We start with a data input, so multiple data points. Then we connect them together based on proximity into a graph, in an arbitrary graph. This graph is not our final clustering result, because this is then split into multiple partitions, smaller partitions. And these partitions are then the input for an agglomerative, so combining and hierarchical clustering approach, where we merge these partitions step by step together to build a final cluster, hierarchical clustering result. This has a big problem, because we have to choose a very good distance measurement for that. We have to find a good sparse graph for the first thing, and then we have to measure the interconnectivity and the intraconnectivity, because again we want to create a good have a high intraconnectivity and a low intraconnectivity and a high interconnectivity. To get to a high relative interconnectivity. Basically, this approach is implemented in a lot of libraries, but it's not that easy to do yourself, because there are multiple variables you can set in here. And basically, that's something that is true for all hierarchical clustering approaches we did talk about till now. Because they are not that easy to set up. You might remember also Agnes or Diana, which also required you to select a very good distance measurement to handle these things. Also, all of these hierarchical clustering approaches we did talk about until now have a big problem with missing attribute values. So if we suddenly do not have Y in this case, we can't handle that, because we need it to, for example, create our CF tree. There is a combined approach. I wouldn't call it a pure hierarchical clustering approach, which tries to solve this problem with probabilities. And basically, that's done assuming a basic distribution. We try to find, we have data points, and we compute the probability that they are computed based on the same distribution. So, for example, we can assume that a set of 1D points, 1D because it's easier to compute. Of course, you can do it with multiple dimensions as well, but let's do 1D in this case. And we have a set of 1D of points which have only one attribute, one dimension, and a numeric attribute again. Now we assume that they are generated by the same Gaussian distribution. And only if a probability is high that they are generated by the same Gaussian distribution, they belong to the same cluster. So how can we compute that a data point is generated by a Gaussian distribution? We can compute the probability using this formula. You should already know this formula from classification. But again, back to my not epilogue, to the things I said before the lecture really started, I wouldn't expect you to compute something like this. A Gaussian distribution is nothing you can compute without a calculator, of course, in the exam. So might be a hint, Baba, I ask you to compute a generative model in the exam. The Gaussian distribution can be used to compute the probability that X is generated by a certain model. However, we need a standard deviation and a mean for that to have a certain fixed Gaussian distribution. And then we can generate the likelihood. Again, something you should already know from decision trees, classification, to find a model, find the parameters, standard deviation, mean, in a way that we try to maximize the likelihood that a point is generated by that distribution. And if we do that for multiple clusters, and we generate multiple different combinations, multiple different standard deviations and means, and we can pick the clusters that best fit every data point. And therefore apply a cluster to every data point in our data set we want to cluster. The good thing with that is that we can also compute the distance of two clusters using this formula, and we can find clusters even if certain data features are missing. The general algorithm, I will go speed quickly through that because it's not a that often used algorithm in most cases. There we go. We have a data set of points again. We want to get a hierarchy of clusters. And then we first create a cluster for each data object. And then for every existing cluster, we find a pair of clusters to minimize or to maximize the likelihood of those being of the same cluster or of the same distribution. And therefore, we also minimize the distance between those two things. And only if we are above a certain threshold, zero, for this distance measurement, then and only then we merge both clusters. So we have a stopping criterion as well in this case. Okay, and that's basically a speed through of what I tried to speed through in 5 minutes last time, so we can get to the next chapter. Are there any questions regarding hierarchical clustering? Okay. Then let's get to density-based methods. Density-based methods are, again, something I want to talk about in detail because one of these methods is pretty good to explain, and it's pretty easy to understand by being pretty mighty. And basically, we will take a look at dbScan in detail in this chapter. But density-based clustering is something that is pretty nice because we are, again, just like with Chameleon, which can also be called a density-based hierarchical clustering method, by the way, we are not setting a certain amount of clusters we want to get, like with k-means, but we take a look at a certain threshold to define which clusters relative to other clusters belong together. In this case, it's density. The big advantage of that is that we can find clusters of arbitrary shapes. And we can also handle noise better than k-means, and we only need one scan. But the big two advantages, I think, are discover clusters of arbitrary shape and handle noise. You might remember last lecture where I said, k-means will never find a cluster like this. dbScan will, and also other density-based methods will. And they are also able to be not confused by an outlier or noise in there, but we will see that in a second. To understand dbScan and other density-based clustering methods, we have to first understand basic concepts. With density-based clustering, we have, in most cases, two parameters. In some cases, we can automize to find these parameters, but in most cases, we have two parameters. We have epsilon, which is the maximum radius of a neighborhood. A neighborhood is something we have to talk about in a second. And we have min points, which is the minimum number of points in an epsilon neighborhood of a point P. Okay. First thing to talk about to understand that is, of course, neighborhood. What is a neighborhood? A neighborhood is pretty much, if you have a data point in here, and we have an epsilon neighborhood, let's say epsilon is 1, and our coordinate system is like this. We are at maybe 2, 1, 0, 3, and let's be at 3, 2, 1, 0, 4. Then an epsilon neighborhood of 1 would just be a circle of radius 1 around this data point, if epsilon is 1. If it's 2, then you have a cycle of 2, a radius of 2, a circle with a radius of 2 around that thing, and so on, of course. And the neighborhood is basically every data point that is within or on that circle. So every data point, every other data point that is in or on the border of that circle, that's important. Also, if you are on the border of that circle, you still count as in the neighborhood. You belong to the neighborhood of our data point A. And basically, this then can be used, and of course, radius 1 is a simplification. Uh, this circle is not always, of course, exactly epsilon, but depends on the distance function. This is true for an Euclidean distance, where our original measurements come through. Basically, the circle is not radius one, but the circle is distance one. The radius is distance one. So if we have Manhattan distance, everything that is lower or equal to a distance of one to that thing is within the radius. But the simplest way to explain it is with Euclidean distance, because it's the most natural way of understanding it. And then we have a core point condition. If we count every data point within our neighborhood, so every point within the distance we specified, then this has to be higher than min points for a point to become a core point. So if we have defined min points as 5 and epsilon is 1 centimeter, again in Euclidean distance to explain this here, then Q would have itself plus 1, plus 2, plus 3, plus 4 points within the neighborhood. So 5 points in total in the neighborhood, itself plus 4 others, which is exactly the minimum threshold to become a core point. So in this example, Q would be a core point because it satisfies that threshold. Itself is also counting towards the neighborhood. That's very important as well. So we have 5 points, and itself is also part of that thing. And P contains a lot more of points within its neighborhood, so it's also a core point, of course. Based on that criterion, we can now define direct density reachability, which is a criterion where point P is direct, or point Q in this case, is direct density reachability from a point P, if P is a core point and Q is within the epsilon neighborhood of a data point. So in this case, P is of course a core point because there are enough points in the epsilon neighborhood, and Q is also within the neighborhood, so we are density reachability, density reachable. And direct density reachable. The next thing is density reachability, where we have to have a chain of direct density reachable points. Maybe let's test whether you have understood direct density reachability. Let's do another example. Let's go with point A in here. And we have 1, 2, I roughly draw a cycle to show the distances. And let's go with an additional point in here. For epsilon, as shown, and min points 4. First thing, is C direct density reachable from A? Raise your hand if you are of opinion that C, this data point, is direct density reachable for these values. One, two, three, four. Who's against it being density direct density reachable? Okay. Most of you, not most of you, but most of the people that took part in the survey are of opinion that we are direct density reachable. Things we have to satisfy for that is that A is a core point, so we have to be 4 points within the absolute neighborhood. One, two, three, four seems to be a core point. And then C has to be within the epsilon neighborhood, which is also true. So yeah, C is direct density reachable from A. Now, if density reachability is defined as a chain of direct density reachability, who thinks that B is density reachable from A? Raise your hand if you are of opinion that B is density reachable from A. And maybe I should have drawn that bigger. You have to tell me if something is too small, because I don't see that from here. I draw it bigger. X, A, A, C, and B. Is that big enough for everybody to be able to comprehend with that? And the circles I've drawn, the ellipses I've drawn, are our epsilon neighborhoods for now, because then it's easier. So you can expect them to be our epsilon neighborhood. Is B density reachable from A in this case? Raise your hand now if you are of opinion that it's density reachable from A with min points equals 4. Raise your hand if you are not of that opinion. Okay, we have at least 6 hands shown. Still not enough, but yeah. Why are you not thinking that it's density reachable? There have been a pretty high majority of people being against it being density reachable. Why do you think it's not density reachable? Yeah?
Because B is not a core point?
Yeah. No. Okay, good thing, good basic idea. We have a problem with core points in that thing. However, it's not B. The problem is not B. The problem is C in this case, because the most obvious choice of chain would, of course, be this chain for density reachability. We already said that C is direct density reachable from A. That's something we already talked about. And C is, of course, direct density reachable from A. Now, the next thing is not from B to C, because we want to reach B from A. So we have to go in this direction. So we have to check next whether B is directly density reachable from C. And for B to be direct density reachable from C, it's required that C is a core point. And since there are only 3 points within its epsilon neighborhood, it's not a core point. So it can't
be part of a chain. Now we can modify two things of our scenario for B to become density reachability, a density reachable from A. One thing, yeah? Yeah, the point itself is also part of the epsilon layout. So, okay, I'm not 100% sure whether I've understood your question, but I have two possible things that you might talk about. So for A, in this case, you have min points equals 4, which is maybe even too small as well. Please remind me if something is too small in the blackboard. I can't see it, but it's very important. But for this cycle, I'm just erasing that to first talk about A. A has itself plus 3 other points in its epsilon neighborhood. So now it satisfies the threshold to become min points. While, and now I'm redrawing this thing, C has itself plus 2 other points, which is of course below min points. It's not a core point. You're nodding, so I guess you have, I've answered your question, so okay. Yeah, the point itself is part of this requirement. So you can't get below min points 1, basically, because you have always yourself within the epsilon neighborhood. That's important. The things we can modify now for this to become a valid chain of points are either, of course, to lower our min points to 3, because now C would be a core point as well, and therefore the chain would work. We would still be C would still be direct density reachable from A, and now, because C is now a core point with min points 3, B is also direct density reachable. The other thing that would be, of course, enough would be to add a second point, which is arguably harder to do because you cluster what you are clustering. But basically, and that's very important, even if we have changed this to min points 3, let's go with that. We now know that B is density reachable from A. However, the other way around is not true. A is not, still not, density reachable from C. Because, from B, not from C, from B. I'm talking about B. Because if we, again, roughly draw a circle around B, there are at maximum 2 points within the epsilon neighborhood. So B is not a core point and can therefore not be the origin of a density reachability chain. So we are directional. Density reachability is directional. And that's basically why we need a third thing, which is density connectedness, to get rid of that directional of this directionality, because density connected are two points are density connected if there's any middle point from which both points are density reachable. Since again in our example, both A and B are density reachable from C, A and B are density connected, because there is at least one point from which you can density reach every other point. And density connectedness is basically what we want to search with density-based clustering methods. So it's very important that you have understood what these things are. Are there any questions regarding core points, density reachability, and density connectedness? There have only been 6 people taking part in the survey. So, to all the others, are there any questions in your heads? Is there any point where you didn't understand what I'm talking about? Okay. There will be a task in the density, there is a theoretical exercise about clustering methods again, starting next week, I guess, if I remember correctly. And within that theoretical exercise, we will talk about those 4 different things again, and there will be an example for all these different data points. Because that's also a pretty nice task for the exam, to simply mark whether something is density connected, is density reachable, and things like that. That's pretty easy to do in the exam, and something I admittedly often do in the exam. But now, if there are not any more questions regarding that, we can get to the actual method using these definitions. And admittedly, it's using density connectedness, which is built on the other things. DBSCAN is density-based spatial clustering of applications with noise. It applies to the definitions we had right now, and therefore it also needs the parameters epsilon and min points to work. The big advantage of that algorithm is that we can find clusters with arbitrary shapes, and we are also not sensitive to outliers. The algorithm itself, and that's something you will also do during the exercise, is that we start with all objects in a database being unmarked. Maybe I should do it in a small example than here as well for you to have an easier time of following me. Let's again go with a thing, and let's go with 4 data points, okay, in this case. Is it big enough? Okay. Then let's say all data points are undersited right now. So we are all having a big hue as being undersited. Now, the first thing is that we select a random point, and it can really be a random point within our data set. So let's go with say stop. Okay, I say stop right here. Let's go with this point. We start with this point, and we mark it as visited. I'm not sure whether my V and my U are good to differentiate, but okay. We mark this point as visited. Now we have to check the epsilon neighborhood of that data point to determine whether it's a core point. Let's go with, let's say this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and also roughly 3, 4, 5. That is around 7, 8, just roughly. And let's go with epsilon in the Euclidean distance, because we always have to specify a distance measurement, is 2 in this case, and min points is also 2, because we have a small example to do that. Okay, now let's take a look at that point and roughly draw a Euclidean distance of 2 around that. Of course, might be a little bit off. In the exercise, you will complete it in detail. But it seems like within the epsilon neighborhood of this data point we selected, there are 3 points. Itself plus 2 others, so it satisfies the threshold to become a core point. So we can skip the first if. We do not have it to mark it as noise because it satisfies the min points threshold. And we go into, otherwise, we create a new cluster for this point. So this point is now in cluster 1. A new cluster we have created. Now the next thing is to say, hey, each point within our epsilon neighborhood becomes part of a list, a candidate set, N. And now, the next step, we go through that candidate set, every point within the candidate set, that isn't yet in a cluster, which is true for both, and do basically what we've done before. We mark the data point as visited, and if not, if it doesn't belong to the cluster, we also add it to the cluster 1 to freshly create a cluster, and also check whether it's a core point. It is, but there are no other unvisited points that are not yet in the list, so we do not have to add any others. So we can finish that up, go to the next point within the list, take a look at this point, mark it as visited, mark it as part of cluster 1, and also check whether it's a core point. It's a core point. No, our unvisited points are within the epsilon neighborhood, so we can finish it up. Now our candidate item set is empty. So we are finished with this iteration. And now we can continue the process with randomly select an unvisited point. Since there is only 1 unvisited point left, we, of course, randomly select this 1 missing point. Check whether it's a core point. It isn't. Therefore, this core point becomes noise. And basically, that's the process. You will do it by yourself on a slightly bigger example, not a really big example, but on a slightly bigger example in the exercise, of course. But the important part is basically this algorithm is looking for density connectedness. And every point that is density connected to each other will end up in the same cluster, while other points either become noise if there are not enough points in the neighborhood to become a cluster themselves, or in another cluster if there are enough points in a cluster. Now back to this point. Why can we end up with something like this? This can happen if these things are close together to be directly density connected. Then we can also create something in a shape like this, which would never be possible in K-means or any partition-based algorithm. So that's why we have this. A very important part with dbScan, however, is that it's really sensitive to our to parameters. We have two parameters to set, epsilon and min points. And depending on which parameter we set in which way, we can end up with hugely different results. For example, in here, with epsilon 1 and min points 5, we have two big clusters, red and orange, in here. While in this setting, where we have epsilon put to 0.7 and min points to 10, we end up with these clusters being split. And those are only slight differences. This cluster down here, I think it would be enough to split it, this one, into this one, if we would simply change epsilon from 1 to 0.7. This cluster up here is only split because we set min points to 10 instead of 5, which is arguably a bigger change, but yeah. One very important part to notice, once you have a result like that, but it's also shown in here, in K-means you will never end up with data points not belonging to a cluster. All data points in K-means will be part of one cluster. In density-based clustering algorithms, you can become noise and therefore become not part of a cluster. And that's how they solve this not being sensitive to noise. Because it's just ignored. But these parameters are, of course, something you have to fine tune in your run throughs with dbScan. But there are also methods to roughly estimate them or roughly solve it. For example, there's optics. Optics is a clustering ordering method. It's also a density-based clustering method, pretty similar to dbScan. However, in optics, we only have to give min points. We do not have to specify epsilon, which is nice. One less parameter to set because it's done automatically. Optics works by creating multiple different density-based results, I would say, and ordering them, order the database according to them. This can be shown also graphically. In this case, we have different epsilons in here, and we have a cluster order. And with optics, we basically try to find an optimum epsilon to select amount of clusters. Because, of course, the lower the epsilon is, the higher the amount of clusters. This is, of course, pretty good for automatic or interactive clustering. So, for example, you can have optics being run and then presented with multiple possible clustering results, and you simply select the one you prefer on your training data.
Yeah. Basically, again, we have a core distance. Not again, but this time we have a core distance of a point P, where we first satisfy the min points argument. So the min epsilon that satisfies our threshold of min points for this point P is our core distance. We increase epsilon step by step to include more and more points. And once we satisfy our min points argument, then we are at core distance. The second thing is the reachability distance. We already talked about density reachability. Behind here. And the density the reachability distance is the minimum radius that makes P part of the epsilon neighborhood of Q and therefore has direct density reachability between both. Not only part of the epsilon neighborhood, of course, it might happen that Q is already within the epsilon neighborhood of P, but min points isn't satisfied, and both has to be true. The reachability distance can't be lower than the core distance. So, for example, we might end up with something like this, where we have min points set to 5, and we end up with a core distance of roughly 3, where we have 5 points within that epsilon neighborhood, and then we might have a higher reachability distance between the two points because, yeah, that's part of it. Since P is closer to Q than the core distance, we of course have to set the reachability distance still to the core distance because otherwise we wouldn't have direct density reachability. That's basically what's shown in here. The real 2.8 centimeter between two points have to be put to 3 centimeters because the core distance is 3 centimeters. It can't be lower than 3 centimeters. The algorithm itself starts with a list of order seeds where we sort points according to that reachability distance. With regard to the respective closest core points. And then we start with, again, a random point, an arbitrary point in the database. And then we check for each point within the set. We first retrieve the closest min points of P to determine the core distance. Then we set the reachability distance to undefined. We write P to output. If P is a core point, then we do, again, an iteration over every point within the epsilon neighborhood of P, similar to this candidate set in dbScan, update the reachability distance from P, insert Q into the evil order seeds list if it hasn't been visited or processed in this case, and move objects in order seeds or sort the order lists according to the lowest reachability distance. And we do that until the database is fully consumed, so empty, similar to candidate set in here, and we end up with a good clustering result. Yeah, any questions regarding dbScan and optics? again, in real world, not in real world, in the things I've seen till now, in use in the industry, I've seen DBSCAN more of use than optics. Because you have more options to fine-tune it, or it's easier to fine-tune than optics. It's also part of more libraries that I know. Of course, that might be not 100% representative, but I guess pretty highly. There's a high probability that that's also the case in all our things. Okay. Now, the last thing we are talking about in regard to density-based clustering is, again, a combination of the core density reachability thing and a statistical approach, just like we had in hierarchical clustering. We, for example, also have DenClue, density-based clustering, which is a pretty nice abbreviation, but it's not the only density-based clustering there is, DenClue. It's using statistical density functions to solve our density-based clustering. For example, again, based on Gaussian distribution in this case, we can compute the influence of a point y on a point x, then compute the total influence on x based on the next formula, and we can also then compute the gradient of x in direction xi. So in a specific direction in our coordinate system or whatever dimensionality we are using, of course. The good thing of that is that we only need maths for that and not an algorithm. We can describe algorithms as math also, but in this case we have only math formula to solve our problem. It's also a pretty solid foundation. This sets with a lot of noise, DBSCAN would have to iterate over all of them. That's pretty expensive. Because we always have to compute the epsilon neighborhood, which is basically, to implement that, we have to compute the distances to everything. We can't just visually see that in an algorithm. We have to compute the distances to every other data point to determine whether we are part of epsilon neighborhood or not, which is computationally expensive. In this case, it's less expensive to handle. And it's therefore also significantly faster than existing algorithms or other density-based clustering algorithms. However, to do that, you will need a high number of parameters to set, even higher than DBSCAN. You do not need just epsilon and min points, but you need to specify thresholds for all of these. Basically, we have a density estimation based on that, where we try to find the underlying probability density function based on our sample data set, and then we try to find a threshold to satisfy our density function. Based on these density attractors, we can then determine our clusters, and we always have center-defined clusters, so we compute the attraction of a center point in this case. Since it's a pretty complicated approach to really use,
I wouldn't go into more detail and rather use the left over 10 methods, 10 minutes, not 10 methods, to go as far in grid-based methods as we can, because, time. Grid-based methods are the last kind of methods we are talking about in clustering. And grid-based methods are, again, a little bit related to hierarchical clustering, I would say. In this case, we are using a multi-resolution grid structure. Multi-resolution is basically, we might have one resolution having this grid. This grid might be split into a lower resolution. This grid might be split into a lower resolution grid, and so on. And that's why I'm saying, hey, it's related to hierarchical clustering, because we have multiple resolutions and therefore also multiple hierarchies within our clustering. The methods we are taking a quick look at are Sting, Wave Cluster, and Click in this case. Let's start with Sting. Sting is a statistical information grid approach. We have multiple layers. In this case, it's just shown in a more three-dimensional way. But basically, we have the lowest resolution, and then go into a more defined, more granular resolution, and go into more and more granular resolutions for each layer. Basically, we just divide our spatial area into rectangular cells, and every cell might contain data points, and therefore data points within one cluster. This hierarchical approach to grid-based clustering is, of course, done by having each cell at a higher level split into more cells in a lower level, just like I've done in here. Remember, this might have been a cluster, a rectangular at a higher level, and it split into four lower levels in the next layer. For each of these cells, we have some statistical information, and that's why it's called a statistical information grid approach, where we calculate basic information about that specific cell, like mean, like average, like standard deviation, and things like that. We can calculate these informations for higher levels from the informations of the lower levels. Not the other way around, of course, because it would be not that easy to do. For example, we can't just compute the mean. If we split these things, we do not know where these little data points are in to split it, these kinds of information. Which is a little bit counterintuitive if you know that Sting is a top-down approach. So you start with the highest layers, and then you go to lower layers. Basically, you can also start from a pre-selected layer go on. We can, in Sting, mark cells as relevant and not relevant, depending on a confidence within the cluster. We only will take a look at layers that are relevant to take a look at when their childs. So only if this bigger part is relevant, then we will continue to take a look at the lower layers within that thing.
with the confidence. We repeat that until we are at the lowest layer, top down. And basically, we take a look, try to find regions that satisfy a certain density specified. In this case, density is not about density reachability, but rather about how many data points are within this rectangular to satisfy a certain threshold. So you can think about that in a urban way of thinking. So a certain to be counted as a mega city, you might only count cities that have 1,000 or 10,000 people per square kilometer or things like that. That's density in this case. Basically, that's the thing. The advantages of that is we can easily parallelize that. We can, for example, do our first layer split and then just take a look at or use one core or one computer to look at children of every certain cell. Big disadvantage of that algorithm are, of course, that we are in a rectangular clustering approach, and therefore we only can take a look at rectangular boundaries and only find rectangular boundaries. So we wouldn't be able to determine that this and this are different clusters. That's something we will not detect. The next thing we are talking about is, can talk about quickly is CLIQ, clustering in Quest. Which is using subspaces, lower dimensional and higher dimensional data spaces, that allow better clustering than the original space. CLIQ is both density-based and grid-based. And we, again, use a density threshold to identify dense cells. However, again, density is defined as exceeding a density threshold, a number of data points within that thing. It's based on the a priori property used in frequent patterns. You hopefully still remember that from the a priori from the frequent pattern lectures. We only take a look at cells that satisfy this threshold to take a look at lower levels. Because if we do not have a city satisfying our density, there's no chance that the other lower levels contain also a density, or the higher levels rather contain this density. Basically, in CLIQ, we start with partitioning each dimension into intervals, identifying intervals with at least one data point. Or not one data point, but L data points. Then we connect these dense cells to combinations of these things and try to find new dimensions that combine them together to combinations like a priori, basically, with our combinations in both sets to find higher dimensions. And each of these candidates, we are now not checking for min support, but we are checking for min density. Again, spoken in a priori terms. And the iteration terminates
if we do not generate any more candidate cells. Basically, just like a priori, but for density clustering. And then these dense cells, these combinations, are then used to create clusters. And we can then apply the so-called minimum density length principle to use the maximum amount of clusters, amount of cells, to cover within one dimension. Which is a simple greedy approach. You start with an arbitrary dense cell and find the maximum region covering that cell. And then we are working on the dense cells we do not have visited or covered or things like that. Basically, visually, and that's the last thing we do for today, Click might end up with cells like this. We just combine these cells together and find the maximum area that still satisfies our density threshold. Adding these other cells would increase the area and is therefore something we aim for. However, it would get us below our density threshold and therefore isn't possible to do. So we try to find as huge as possible area that still satisfies our density threshold. Basically, that's the case. And there are weaknesses and strengths to that, but yeah. I skip that to speed things up today. Of course, these methods I just run through in less detail are also only required in less detail in the exam. I think that's something that should be obvious, but I say it again in here. Next time, we will finish up the clustering chapter with evaluation. With evaluation of clustering and also how to find good parameters as part of that evaluation chapter. And we also will start with our last chapter of outliers, which is a separate chapter we are talking about. Okay, have a nice day and see you again next week.